back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake
McClure,
in this second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, July 4th, 2015. And if you are out there and it's also July 4th, 2015 where you are, then you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And somebody has already taken me up on that, so call her on 773-1400. You're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th
Thank
to you.
You.
Can you contribute to a SEP IRA if you are 70 and a half, still working, and are taking out your required minimum distribution?
You going to look that one up?
I am.
I'm going to look that up. I'm going to say probably yes. Jake's looking it up right now. That's one of those things. That I know that you can contribute to a pension plan, and I think an SEP falls into the heading of pension plan. If you have a 401k, 403b, PQRST, RV, WXYZ, any of that stuff, and it's not an IRA, not just a standalone IRA, I'm pretty sure, I know you can contribute to what are called defined contribution retirement plans, and I know you can't contribute to an IRA. What's the answer?
Because a SEP, are you the only person in the SEP?
Yes.
Okay. Because a SEP is designed for employers to give to their employees, you are allowed to contribute after 70 and a half.
Ah.
Oh, okay.
But you also must take the minimum distributions.
Right.
That's also true if you have a 401k. You got to take the minimum distributions. In fact, we have clients who are doing that.
Right.
Who are contributing to 401ks.
And taking money out of the 401k at the same time.
Okay.
Actually, they're taking money out of a different account.
Right.
Yeah, it is a bit complicated. You got to do both.
So, are you over 70 and a half?
My husband is, yes.
Okay. I was going to say, you don't sound like you're over 70 and a half.
Well,
I'm approaching 70.
She's just led a really high-quality life and avoided screaming at people,
certainly.
And so your voice is very nice and melodious.
I warn people with... There are two plans that were set up to be simplified. And anytime simple is part of a governmental word, it means the opposite. So simplified employee pension is a SEP for those people that have heard us talking and don't know what a SEP is. But there's also something called a simple IRA, which is not necessarily simple either. None of the things involved in retirement accounts are simple.
But I think, and you want to check, now, there's lots of caveats here. The simplified employee pension, like the simple plan, has a lot of pages associated with it.
Yes.
And as a result, you really need to get confirmation from a tax professional before you act, because we don't give tax advice, even though we'll tell you what the facts are. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So with
I was just concerned about the SEP, because that's what he has always had.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
then that makes sense that if to help an employee,
right,
and they would be able to continue.
From the perspective of the IRS and the perspective of the government, what they're seeing is two different people involved here. Even though there's only one person involved, you're both making the contribution and the withdrawal. From the IRS's perspective, it's your employer making the contribution and the employee making the withdrawal.
The IRS believes that everybody should have at least two persons living in.
Right.
And if you're self-employed, that's a form of insanity, and you have multiple personality disorder.
And if they can tax each of you, they will be happy doing so.
Yes, they do, by the way.
Yeah, so you will be not taxed on the money that's contributed, but you will be taxed on the money that comes out.
Yes. Matter of fact, could do is take the minimum required distribution and contribute to the SEP.
Put it right back in, huh?
Yes, and that way you avoid paying taxes on it, or do you defer taxes?
Defer taxes for later. Now, you definitely need to talk to a tax preparer on that one.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
But there are some concepts that people, they basically take the money out. They have to pay taxes on the money, which is where you get a little bit weird.
And your business has to be profitable, at least to the extent that you're contributing to the SEP.
Otherwise, you're just putting it in there so that you can pay taxes on it twice. You don't want to do that.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Well, have a great day.
Welcome. You too. Have a good 4th.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we talked last hour about how the 4th was officially observed on the 3rd, which makes this not the 4th.
Right. There are several institutes that just from that last caller there are several institutes that have are putting together proposals for Congress. I'll say that 10 times fast. That basically are saying this whole retirement plan system is way too complex and much too obscene, basically. If you have an IRA, you're allowed to put in $5,500. If you've got a 401k, you're allowed to put in
$22,000
plus contributions made by employers, so you could be up to like $53,000 in wealth.
And if you have a DBA, you can literally sometimes, depending on what assumptions the actuary makes, you can put in $124,000.
Right. So doing business as is the DBA. So that
no, I don't mean DBA. Defined benefit plan.
Right.
Sorry, defined benefit.
DBP.
DBP.
So you have all of these different options, and it really depends on your employment status, who you are, and how that whole concept is insane, actually, when you come right down to it. It's not fair. It's not set up for fairness in mind. In fact, kind of the reverse. And there are several institutes that are putting together plans that basically replace all of it.
But you have to have it tested.
Right.
For fairness.
Right. You know, in the 401ks, you have to have test this, fairness tests.
The problem with simplifying them is that there is a huge industry with lots of money and lots of lobbyists
that make a lot of money.
Who make a lot of money off the complexity of retirement plans.
Right. And if it were simplified,
if you could actually understand it, you wouldn't need that.
Yeah. The idea behind the simplification, all of the proposals that I've said start with one concept, which is you have an account that's empty when you're born. And you take that account with you to each of your employers or to yourself if you're self-employed. And your employer adds money to that with the same vesting type options that they have in their normal 401k. That means that if you leave after a year and they say you can't get this money until you've been with us 3 years, you don't keep that money. So that concept is there so that they can say, this is a benefit that employers are offering, because without it, people would be wanting to work at other places. So if the company's matching your money, or they're making contributions on their own, and they're putting bonuses in or whatever, they still have the ability to retain that if you haven't been with them for a while. But you have the ability to contribute to the same place your entire life. And you can set it up in an easy way or a complex way. Well, you can do whatever you want with it at that point.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I don't think it's ever going
to
happen, though.
No, it's the easy way to do this would be really simply to say, if you're making money and you have earned income as opposed to income from interest and capital gains and so on, you should be able to put away 20% of it, pay your Social Security and Medicare taxes on that 20%, but not pay income taxes on it, and defer it to your retirement. Now, why do I say 20%? Because there's lots of studies out there right now. It used to be 10% theoretically would get the job done, but that was in a much higher return environment. If a person puts away 20%, if they, from the day they start working, if they put away 20% of everything they own into a retirement account, and they get a mediocre return, which today is something like maybe 4 or 5% a year, which is certainly higher than you're going to get in the bank, then when they retire, they will have enough money to continue to live to their probable life expectancy at the same standard of living, presuming they leave it in some place where they can get a mediocre rate of return. And if they put away less, they won't have enough money to live. Now, obviously, people who do have enough money at that point in history have not had to put away 20%. And that was mainly because if you look at, and believe me, we do look at this, an awful lot of money was made by people who had 401ks or 403bs if they were in something other than an insurance product, if they were in securities in the 1990s. And those who hung in there, those who invested into the 1990s, but then didn't take it all out, or they didn't strip down to and go to cash or do whatever silliness that people very commonly do, today have a name, and it's called wealthy. And they started in many cases with nothing, and they invested steadily, and they took advantage of the boom, which occurs about once in a working lifetime, and I think we may be going into one, by the way. And as a result of doing that, they did okay. But the rest of the population did not, and they're working at Lowe's, and they're working at Walmart, and they're working at a lot of places bagging groceries. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, could you explain what the export-import bank is, why it's good or bad, and how it's used, and what's the bill in the Congress concerning that?
Okay.
And I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. That's a good, very good question. Export-import bank.
Import-export bank.
The import-export bank.
Oh, it's export-import. I'm sorry.
I thought it was export-import. The export-import bank finances the purchase of goods.
It did up till the first. It's not doing it at the moment.
Historically has financed the purchase of goods by foreign entities from American manufacturers. So it's very similar to if you go to GM, if you go to a GM dealer or a Ford dealer or whatever, they have an internal finance facility that will encourage you to buy their car over someone else's car by giving you a much lower payment, a much lower interest rate, a much better deal than you might be able to get somewhere else. Therefore, you have a tendency to buy the car there rather than somewhere else. So the United States, for instance, if Caterpillar wants to sell, we talked about Ghana a minute ago, wants to sell a company, or Brazil, Caterpillar or Halliburton or somebody wants to sell a bunch of equipment to Brazil, to a company in Brazil, Petrobras, which runs their oil fields and all of that. Getting financing for Petrobras right now would be a real difficult thing because they may not pay it back.
Well, this is something key here. We're going to get to more information. But
what happens is that money never leaves the United States. It goes to Caterpillar or it goes to Halliburton so that Halliburton can do this export. And it helps the economy tremendously and is really not a boost for any foreign country. It's just it's an international loan made for exactly the same reason that GMAC made loans and Ford Motor Credit made loans and General Electric Credit made loans in their original form. General Electric became the largest company and ran over what was the other company? Its competition when it I can't think Westinghouse. Westinghouse was bigger than General Electric. General Electric ran over Westinghouse and in essence ran Westinghouse out of existence because General Electric financed its own deals.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things here. Number one, this is most important if you're in the Tea Party. It doesn't cost the taxpayers anything. In fact, every year it makes a profit. Last year it made $675 million, which it used to pay down the deficit. This is a organization, the caller asked how it was set up. It was set up under executive order, which before you get upset, it was in 1934, executive order made it happen. However, in 1945, Congress passed a law making it an executive branch department. So Congress has recognized the executive order by law. It isn't one branch or the other. In fact, this is something that rarely happens. It's something that both the executive and the legislative branches got together and said, we need this. It is very bipartisan. It is the concept here is most of the vast majority of their loans are made to small businesses that are exporting products outside the United States and sometimes to small businesses that are importing products that they are then turning around and creating something new out of. The idea here is to support high-paying jobs in the United States with a bank that's able to make these loans. And in the case of like Boeing, in order for it to make a loan, Boeing, not the export-import bank, in order for Boeing to make a loan to, say, the country of Thailand when they want to buy some jets, Boeing has to get that money from somewhere. So it goes to the United States government, and the government says, we're going to use the export-import bank. We're going to give you a loan. It's going to be a low-interest loan. so that when you turn around and give the loan to Thailand, you may not get paid back, but it'll be easier to pay back the loan that you got from the Export-Import Bank. So basically, the concept here is being used as a pawn on the chessboard of politics right now. They're making it sound like it is a costly entity that is paying foreign governments. It's none of those things. It is a non-costly, profitable entity that's paying U.S. corporations and U.S. business owners.
The result of the fact that the U.S. Export-Import Bank, got shut down, got defunded by Congress, effectively on January 1st.
July 1st.
I'm sorry, July 1st. Yeah, I'm going to get my tang untangled here. The fact that it got shut down, and by shut down, I mean all that happened was the Republicans in the House primarily blocked the continuing authorization for it to exist. It doesn't require any funding. It's self-funding. Caused Boeing to lose many, many, many. I don't remember. It was a large number. It was in, I think, the hundreds of billions of dollars, ultimately, of orders to Airbus, because I'll assure you, the European Union has a facility funded mainly by the Germans and the French that will finance Airbus exports. So, and I may have the country wrong. I think it's Thailand. Just ordered a whole bunch.
Yeah, that's what
economic term of Airbuses before Congress started threatening to shut down the Export-Import Bank. Boeing pretty much had that one in the bag. But Airbus got the order, and so the French and German economies got the boost, and the United States economy did not get the boost, all in the name of shutting down the Export-Import Bank, which is...
It's the Koch brothers that have mostly funded the lobbying efforts to make this not go forward. And they're making a lot of money out of it not going forward because they're able to make deals that their competitors are not. The smaller companies are not. Usually I think the Koch brothers are decent enough people, but they definitely have their own interests in mind.
Oh, yeah.
They're spending money, lots of money, to talk to people at Congress to make it so that this is not renewed, and it's been going for 81 years.
Well, I think they're at least claiming that they're doing it as a matter of principle that the United States should not be involved in assisting company in doing exports. That if a company does its exports, it should do it on its own. However,
that's not the way the rest of the world works.
Every major industrial nation on the planet, except the United States, as of July 1st, has the equivalent of the Export-Import Bank financing exports.
Yeah, if we don't and they do, it makes it easier to buy from other countries than it is to buy from the United States. It's already hard to buy from the United States right now because the dollar just got more valuable.
Well,
and that means that if you're in Thailand, it's more expensive to buy from the United States to begin with. And then if you can't get financing, then why not just go to the French? The euro's dropped. That means that they're having a sale on Airbus. And they have easy loans available.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does isn't it doesn't help us in any way that I see.
And it's really a parallel to...
It's not hurting us.
It's a parallel to what goes on in housing in the United States. If you're listening out there and you're living in a house, odds are the mortgage that you're either using to buy or used to buy your house was ultimately backed by a federal agency. And the result of that backing by a federal agency is that you got your mortgage a lot less expensively than you otherwise would have been able to get your mortgage. Therefore, you bought the house. Therefore, you wound up ultimately employing people to build new houses, either directly or indirectly. And we've seen one of the reasons that this particular recovery that we're in right now is very, very slow. It's like a tortoise plodding along, which is not a bad deal. We were getting kind of tired of the ups and downs, and now we have this very slowly recovering economy, but no no real excitement up or down. But the point is, one of the reasons this is such a slow recovery, and it has taken so long, is because we restricted home loans probably excessively. We managed to scare the fire out of everybody, and noises continue to be made about shutting down Fannie and Freddie, and that causes people who want to make loans to purchase houses. In other words, they buy bonds, in essence, that give the banks money that then enable them to invest that money in the purchase of a house, and then you pay it back. Those people are very hesitant to do so because they're afraid that the implicit government rescuer of last resort position will go away. And we have a tremendous amount of lower employment right now because of that. And the same thing is true on the Export-Import Bank. Exports have been the bright spot for some time. We eliminate financing for exports on a matter of principle, and people will simply, let me give you an example. Boeing could move its operations to Canada, where they do have an import-export bank, and continue to function very nicely.
And at this point, this is a point right now, we're talking about the current scenario, our year. We're trying to convince companies that are doing business abroad, that are American-based companies, to bring back their money so that we can get taxes from them. We're trying to convince them, bring your money back here. If you leave it over there, the Republicans are talking about possibly taxing it when it's elsewhere. At the beginning or in the middle part of every economic collapse, you have an urge to try to grab as much tax revenue as possible from, and these are air quotes, the rich fat cats. The problem is that the rich fat cats aren't people anymore. They're not a single person. They're a group of people in company. There are a huge number of people that are American citizens that are owning things abroad and doing things abroad that are making money. If they bring that money back here, it gets taxed. And now we're making it harder for them to
get taxed again.
Yeah, to get taxed again, yes.
Because they've already paid taxes overseas.
And we're making it harder for them to make money here by not having financing available. Mm-hmm. Now, the Koch brothers don't need the financing. They have a very large amount of cash sitting on hand. They don't need the financing. It's the smaller business. 90% of the volume, the amount of money that's being made in these loans, goes to small businesses. And the small businesses that are getting these loans, by and large, right now, are natural gas. Natural gas and oil companies. These are the fracking groups that we hear about having trouble right now. Well, the Koch brothers are in competition with them. That's what they do for a living. You line these things up, and it sounds like we've got this rhetoric for free market. And believe me, I'm 100% behind free market, but not if the free market is, I'm going to go in and compete for your goods, but every other government out there is going to make other people's offers look better. So if we can't get a even playing field, then it isn't a free market.
It's rather like, I don't know, the bottom line to it is the Export-Import Bank has historically been a bipartisan good thing.
It still is. It's still a pretty small amount of people that are stopping it.
Well, but we have a section of the right-wing Republican Party right now that has effectively blocked funding for something that is...
It's not even funding. It's just blocked its authorization.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need funding.
They
point.
Blocked the
it
authorization.
It makes money. It brings money back in.
And the rest, one of the most fascinating things to me in this is it reduces the deficit to have the Export-Import Bank. So we've just increased the deficit.
Yes. By $675 million, which isn't that big a deal in any given year. But it's the reverse direction.
It's most of a billion and is... Sam Irwin has famously said, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you start talking about some real money.
Did I just say $675 million wasn't that much?
Yeah, well,
I did say that, didn't I?
Yeah, I did, and I don't necessarily agree with you. But you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are on KTEM, and that means we have commercials we need to play. The telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. If you're back next hour, you will hear us make more ludicrous claims of large amounts of money being...
Back next hour.
Or back after the break. You'll hear us make more ludicrous claims of hundreds of millions of dollars being not much money. Pretty ludicrous.
Well, we did say that Greece's default is no big thing, and
no,
it's only
deal.
$500 billion.
It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, Lord willing, we'll be back after these words from KTEM sponsors.
Let's say you suddenly need to see a doctor.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, July 4th, 2015. And if you'd like to give us a call in here, it's 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Well, we talked a little bit about the markets. Let me give you a little summary of what's going on in the equity markets. Most people don't even look at them over a year. So although we like to look at them at a minimum of 5 years, 1 year is illustrative of what's going on in the big picture. The Dow Jones Industrial Average 52-week result at the moment is up 3.88%. Based on 1 year, the S&P 500 is up 4.6%. The NASDAQ is up 11.67%, having finally closed in on where it was in 2000. And as a result, what we're seeing is, if you're looking at your stock portfolio, and I've actually had people say this, the market is really up. I understand the market's at record highs, and it doesn't look like my portfolio has gone much of anywhere. Yeah, that's right. It probably hasn't gone much of anywhere. As a matter of fact, year to date, the Dow is down 0.5%. The S&P 500 up less than 1%. The NASDAQ up about 6%. And the NASDAQ, of course, is a place where you get some really high variance, a lot of high volatility, and long periods of loss or gain, as the case may be. So it's kind of an exciting place to be, and people don't particularly care for that kind of excitement because it's kind of a bipolar depression exaltation area. So what's coming? I've read a lot of people whose historic prognostications concerning the market have been quite accurate over the years. And they pretty consistently are saying we will get a better return in the second half than the first half, and that we're looking at some pretty fair returns this year and a pretty good economy this year. Right now, that is not apparent. But that is the nature of investing, and it's a very important thing to understand the nature of investing. There are basically three categories of investors. There are the people who... buy high and sell low with amazing consistency. And there's a lot of them. And they actually lose money over time, in many cases, all the while thinking they're making money. Then you have people who are kind of in the middle. They do make some money for a while, and then they bail out because they get scared, and they get back in. And over a long period of time, in some cases, they'll make a little money or they'll lose a little money, but they won't be particularly happy. The third group of investors, and this is a very important thing to understand, and these investors are in a minority, are the people who buy into a good long-term plan. And I say buy in. They allocate their money. They recognize their ability to tolerate market downturns, or they just have a high ability to tolerate a market downturn. They have a long time horizon. They do their research carefully, or have somebody else that is worthy of trusting do their research carefully, and stick with their long term plan for a long term, because there's a fundamental issue that has worked so far in the market since it has been discovered. And that is, if you look at the long term, and I mean as long as you can get it, average returns in different parts of the investment markets, particularly over in equities, that particular part of the investment markets, after accounting for inflation, tends to have pretty much that same return over the long term. And by the long term, I mean like 30 years. It sounds like a bit long for many people when it talks to a time horizon, but it gives you a pretty good guide. It is the best guide available, and it can be worked around and worked through. The other thing is, over on the bond side, and a lot of people are aware of this now, there's a very simple rule. The higher interest rates are, the less people want to invest in bonds, because rising interest rates cause the bonds to fall. And as a result, they tend to shy away from bonds after periods of rising interest rates, which, of course, are the best time to invest in bonds. And after people have been losing money in bonds for a long time, if you invest in bonds, you'll probably make a lot of money for a long time. Now, the reverse of that is true.
People have been making a lot of money in bonds for a long time, which means that if you invest now, you're in for a little bit of a shock.
Unlike,
it's not going to be good.
Unlike stocks, bonds are so eminently predictable. If you get investment-grade bonds and you get a nice big portfolio of them and you look at their yields and maturity, that's what you're going to get. That is just an amazing reality.
And if the yield to maturity is negative because people have been buying them up, then you're locking in on a negative
Return.
A negative return. It's negative growth. That's not what we want in a portfolio.
And right now, the highest quality bonds in the world have negative interest rates, which means that, you know, you buy them and...
that's not even yield to maturity stuff. That's just full-on face value and it's got a negative interest rate.
You are actually paying somebody to borrow money from you, because you're convinced they will pay it back and you're not convinced that anybody else will.
Right. And
or that your currency will be around.
I wouldn't mind a bit if my mortgage company paid me to get the mortgage from them and they paid me every month. I make my payment.
Move to Switzerland.
But that means that one of the interesting factors there is they're not making a lot of loans. Banks aren't stupid. They don't I'm going to give you a loan because you're going to pay it back and I'm going to pay you to do it. They say, no, I'm going to hold on to my money for a while. Thanks.
I was looking at the cost of houses and the difficulty of getting home loans in Switzerland, by the way.
Yeah, you've got to buy with cash.
It's harder than it is in Austin.
Yeah, it's a lot harder.
Which is pretty hard. And the housing prices there are really absurdly high. And so the issue is, in the United States right now, for example, it's a borrower's market, and I hate to say that in light of the fact that we probably have totally worldwide too much debt, but still a borrower's market.
Yeah, if you can get a loan, you're going to get it at a very low interest rate.
And your interest rate...
It's not going to last.
The historic rate of inflation over a 30-year period has been about 3%. So if you get a 3.26% 30-year mortgage on my house, that means that after I take my deduction for interest, and I have enough income that I can do that, I take my deduction for interest, and I take my deduction for property taxes, the actual net interest rate on the house that I live in,
if you count out inflation,
is less than probable inflation over the next 30 years, which means effectively...
You're making money on the loan.
I am being paid a small amount of money every year to have a mortgage on my house, which is an exceptionally good deal. And it's rare. It's a once-in-a-generation event that occurs. So there's a couple of pretty obvious things here. One, have enough money to weather a short-term downturn.
Yes.
Yes, whatever.
One of those things.
Yes, because they're going to come. We have just broken a record of the number of consecutive months without a 10% or greater fall in the S&P 500. We've now gone the longest period in record. It's one of those little records that goes by that everybody on Wall Street kind of whispers about and tiptoes around because they don't want to put a curse on it. We will get one at some point. And it could be something as simple as Greek. There's a stumble, and the Greeks do exit the Eurozone, and everybody thinks they've got it all covered, but they really don't have it covered. And the end result is that something blows up like a hedge fund that we don't know about that's holding a lot of Greek positions, for example. And when that hedge fund blows up, it has to sell a bunch of stuff that sets a bunch of stuff, other things going on. And everybody panics for a short period of time, and we get a 10 or 15% drop in the market and then a recovery. Could that happen? Yes. Is it going to happen? Typically, if it is, it's going to happen in September or October. Just like at the beginning of July, end of June, we get market dips. Well, we get one this year. Small one. Have the money to get through that. But have a significant amount of your investments in something that has long-term growth potential. That's just bottom line. The people who do that over long periods of time, I get to look at their portfolios every once in a while and just shake my head in awe. And I congratulate them, and they say, well, we don't know anything about the markets. And I said, oh, yeah, you do. You understand them far better than you know, because your patience and diligence and absence of panic made you a heck of a lot of money. So that's just
right.
Diversification is key to that. You can't put all your money in Enron and expect to make a fortune. Matter of fact, greed and is your enemy in that, just like fear is. So that's just 2 cents worth. Right now we have if you've got a 5-year return of between 5 and 8% in your portfolio per year,
You're doing great.
Exceptionally well.
And if you look at what's going on in China right now, you know, people at the beginning, well, just a month ago, they were talking about the returns in the Chinese stock market.
Yeah, you get like 100% return, 150% return.
Well, now it's down. It's down drastically over a year.
It's only down like about 30%.
Only 30%.
But over a 1-year period, it's still up a bunch.
Right. And that concept of being down there, now the Chinese are digging into short sellers and who's manipulating the market, it's kind of interesting because this is the sort of investigation that will eventually, if they're not careful, make them capitalists. When they look around and they say that the market is necessary and that manipulators need to get out of there, well, the people manipulating the market in China are the Chinese authorities. So if they just continue with where they're going to get a less people's-oriented economy, although that's kind of hard. You've mentioned this a couple of times on the radio a few times. The renminbi, the yuan renminbi.
Yes.
The name of
RMB,
the currency.
Yeah.
Yes. And why does it have two names? And I've actually looked it up over the week so that we could actually have, I mean, it's called the yuan renminbi when we're talking about it, and they usually throw them together. A lot of times they'll say the yuan. Well, what renminbi, I'm mispronouncing it horribly. I listened to how to pronounce it, and the way it's spelled are not exactly the same. Anyway, I'm mispronouncing it, but it means people's currency. And the yuan is one denomination, the most commonly used. Yes, it's the most commonly used denomination of of renminbi.
It's like the Swiss have the franc, as do the French.
Only not anymore. The French have the euro.
The French
now.
Used to have the franc. Now they have the euro. But the point is that the name of the currency and the name of the lowest denomination of the currency were the same. And that is true in most countries, but China, in its great desire to be different and better, has two different names for the lowest denomination of the currency and the currency itself.
No, the yuan is the most commonly used denomination. It's not the lowest.
It's like, it isn't the lowest?
No, it's the most commonly used. It can be broken into 100, just like a dollar can.
Well, yeah, but the base number is yuan. Anyway, it is weird. By the way, China is teetering along, and
what I was going to mention here is that they're putting together something similar to the SEC, which they haven't had over there. They haven't had a group that just looks for fraud in the marketplace, because that's really secondary to them. They're a communist organization. Fraud is not something that boggles my mind a little bit, that they're taking this much time to finally get to a point where they say, if someone is trading on information that nobody else has, that's insider information, and they haven't considered that a crime up till now.
It took us from 1776 until the 1930s to set up the SEC.
Right, right. It took us a long time, but we've had it a long time, and usually what they've done is tried to follow in the same path that we've followed. And
okay, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I'm on the. If y'all can change the subject slightly, there's a at least in his mind a world famous investor in the Dallas area that talks about getting out of the market,
mm-hmm.
and staying out for a couple of years, and he's I'll call that time back.
Right.
I don't know of anybody else that markets or invest in that manner. And my question is that a other than you don't ever. You're seldom successful time in the market. Is that a valid?
Well, I think I have a simple answer for that. I've read a lot of studies on market timers where people have tried to follow market timing strategies or market timing advice through the years. And to date, very careful examinations have never found one that worked.
Well,
it's a really good way to lose a lot of money. And if you have a world-famous investor who's calling for it, there's a fairly good chance he's trying to trigger a market downturn so he can buy what you sell.
Yeah, and there's a side to this that is important to recognize. If you look at the history of the market and you see the downturns that happen in the marketplace, and that doesn't make you feel good, over a long period of time, if you look at the graph and you see the bumps, now, if you look over at a long period of time, you see that the market is substantially up over a long period of time. But if you look at any given period while it's down, if it makes you feel horrible, you shouldn't be in the market to begin with. But what I'm going from with this information is that the market, you know, it's not magic. People get returns in the market because they're willing to pay, they call it the risk premium.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes it's not up, sometimes it's down. And if you can't afford that risk, if you can't afford seeing your portfolio go down, then you should be out, and it doesn't matter. You shouldn't be in to begin with.
There's a very key element in all these studies that everyone has found. It is not hard to successfully identify when the market is overpriced, which, by the way, it is not at present.
It is not. And yeah.
But it is not at all hard to successfully identify an overpriced market and say, get out, and that your getting out caused you to avoid a downturn. That's easy. Lots of people have done it over the years. The problem is when to get back in. What happens is, there will be fake rises in the market along the way. And so the market timers, without exception over time, and by the way, I followed several market timers just to see what would happen had I done what they said to do. Very successful ones at various times, rough times. There was a whole series of them over the years that I followed. And when I was a stockbroker, I had a customer that did major, major market timing. And he followed all of the charts, and he did everything and spent a tremendous amount of time at it and managed to lose a very substantial amount of money. The problem with all of that is not when to get out. It's when to get in. And inevitably, people who jump back in too late, and the market has already run up. So they wind up, and listen to this carefully, they wind up selling high and buying higher, which is the equivalent of selling low and buying high. So they lose money on the round trip.
Right. So I'm not sure who the world-famous investor is that's saying get out of the market completely, but I would disagree unless you shouldn't be in the market to begin with.
He hangs his hat on he told his clients to get out of the market in 2007 and avoided the great meltdown of
you know what?
7 and 8.
He got lucky. But when did he get back in?
In 2009, latter part of 2009.
Okay. So he missed part of the up market. But the point is, the history, and I've been at this now for 33 years, and I've seen so many world famous investor advisors or investors who have properly called either 1987 or 1998 or 2000 through 2002. Or any of the major markdowns, and they become very, very, very famous people. The problem is they miss the next one without exception, and they fade into oblivion because the people who did what they told them to do may have worked once, but it's kind of like if you have a clock that stopped, it's right twice a day.
And there's another piece here, and this is a big one. This piece is, if you look at the great investors, the ones that everyone knows are great investors,
and that stay great,
that don't go around saying, I'm a world famous investor. Talk about Warren Buffett, for instance.
John Templeton.
These are people that didn't get out when they got in.
Mm-hmm.
They got in because they recognized the validity of what they were buying, the value that was being created, the profit that was available there, and then they stayed in. And sometimes the portfolio dropped, and they didn't miss that. But they have this long-term return because they're becoming part of what they're buying. They're not looking at it as a dollar figure that they sell or buy. That's playing a game. And the market is not a game. The market is where people don't say, I play the game of owning my house, not unless they're joking, because owning your house isn't a game. It's mm-hmm. something that you do for the benefit of living in it.
There is a fundamental thing that works in the market long term, and that is buying value. There's no Nobel Prize given out on this. What it boils down to is if you buy stocks well diversified, which means you would need to use a mutual fund or something similar, if you buy stocks that are trading below their intrinsic value, and that is what Warren Buffett does, and that's what John Templeton did, and that's what Philip Curry did, and you go back, these great investors who managed to guide people who were investing through them or
Benjamin
with them
Graham.
over the years to tremendous fortunes. What they have done consistently is buy into value as opposed to growth. Growth are the hot stocks, the stocks that have high earnings and high priced earnings multiples and high forecasted earnings, and their stock prices get really high and everybody loves them and everybody and your cousin wants them. Value stocks are by definitions ones that are out of favor. And of course, the trick is selecting the set of stocks, the set of companies that's out of favor, but are good companies. And that takes a lot of work. And consistently, there are two things that over time have been, proven, but never disproven as a method to have relatively great wealth accumulation over a long period of time. And that is this: if you buy value stocks as opposed to growth stocks, and if you buy smaller stocks as opposed to larger stocks. Smaller companies tend to rise more in the future than larger companies. And stocks that are undervalued, their share prices are unfairly pushed down, tend to rise more than stocks that are overvalued. I mean, like, excuse me, but duh. But that's not that is boring. It's counterintuitive in both cases. You won't be able to say that you own a company that everybody recognizes, because by definition, value stocks that are smaller tend to be unrecognized companies that in many cases are very, very profitable. They've just had their stock price pressed. Forced down unfairly. So Eugene Fama, the Fama French Nobel Prize, actually there's three factors. There's another one in there too, but that's a little harder to figure. But those two factors that they determined were consistent over time are consistent over time. And that's how, for instance, the Texas Teachers Retirement System does a large part of its investing, and you'll notice that unlike other retirement systems or General Motors retirement system or Yale's famously hugely successful until it wasn't system, the boring Texas Teachers Retirement System and the system that the state of Texas uses to fund its government pensions, its state pensions, has just been percolating along without any fame, without any crisis. Just percolating along, and nobody has suggested it needs a government bailout. And it's because it does what I just said. Diversification, uses asset classes as its basis for investment, and buys value and smaller investments. That's just reality, okay?
So hopefully we touched on enough rationale. There, this is something that is, it's hard for me to comprehend, but it's out there, so I'm going to address it. And the thing that it's hard for me to comprehend is that there's this feeling that there are people in the world that simply know
the future.
The future. They just know. Somehow they've put together.
There are.
And they say that this event is going to happen. So,
they're called insider traders.
Right. When we're talking about.
And they go to jail.
The panic of 2007, 2008, the Great Recession. If we look at the underlying issues of the economy, there just weren't that many bad things going on. The overloaning in the real estate market was a real issue. Our response to it was much magnified from what it needed to be. Our response as a people was to sell massively. We all got scared. We panicked. This is why we call these things panics. And when they happen, they're almost impossible to predict, because most people would say, well, the vast majority of rational-minded people aren't going to panic over this. We're going to recover from it. If you can predict the irrational panics and the irrational booms that follow, then you don't really need to be telling the world when to get out and when to get in. You're already too wealthy.
Let me give you a book if you want to understand this. It's called Rational Expectations, Asset Allocation for Investing Adults by William Bernstein. It was just published. I haven't read it, but I've just read a review of it in the Wall Street, in Barron's, rather. And it basically, and William Bernstein I know of, that's all the smart money information that you'll need to have if you want to be a successful investor. And we're out of time.
Yes. Thank you very much for the call.
Rational Expectations.
Rational Expectations by William Bernstein. Okay?
Thank you. All right.
Thanks for the call.
And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And as we disclaim at the beginning, we don't disclaim
it. We're not disclaiming anything.
No, as we disclose at the beginning, the Personal Wealth Coach is an investment advisor registered with the SEC and in Salado, Texas. And if you'd like to call us off the air, either to talk to us as investment advisors or to make suggestions for the show, the program, you can give us a call. And locally, we have a telephone number, voicemail on weekends, live people during the week at 947-1111, or
you can reach that same voicemail toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and you can listen to podcasts. You can read our philosophy, read our newsletter, see our made-for-radio faces. You can also see the staff that we work with on a regular basis. So we're certainly proud of them.
Well, have yourself a safe, healthy, and careful 4th of July.
Happy Independence Day.
And just be glad we are independent and be very, very thankful today.
KTM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News.